The daily podcast of The Exchange is supported by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. More information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Welcome to another in our series of Rudman Center Conversations with the Candidates, coming to you from the Rudman Center at UNH School of Law. Our guest tonight is the Republican nominee for New Hampshire Governor Walt Havenstein. On Thursday, we'll talk with Democratic 1st District Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter. I'd also like to thank the sponsors of this series, Eastern Bank and Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. Throughout the hour, in addition to my own questions, we'll be sharing questions we received from our listeners before this event, and we'll take questions from our audience here at the Rudman Center. And Mr. Havenstein, welcome. Thanks for giving us your time.
Well, thank you, Laura. It's always a pleasure to be back at the Rudman Center. It's exactly this purpose that the center was created, and Judy and I have been proud to be sponsors of the center. And of course, Senator Rudman was a great fan of the company I came to run here. And Sanders, his daughter, worked at there, and Senator Rudman was a great mentor for me while I was at the company.
Well, and you mentioned your business background, sure. Mr. Havenstein, so let's talk about that. Sure. As you run for governor, you're promoting that background, a leader at two major U.S. corporations, including BAE Systems, right, here in New Hampshire. Describe for us, please, how you would translate that private sector experience to the public sector, where the needs and problems, as I'm sure you know, are very different.
Yeah, they are very different, and frankly, the leadership styles for public service or for running as a governor are very different than they are for the private sector when it comes to leading a corporation. But I would tell you there's some fundamental elements of leadership that are very much the same. And my leadership experience didn't start in industry. It started in public service as a United States Marine. My first leadership experience coming out of the Naval Academy was to lead 110 Marines. That was the size of the platoon I had in California. And when you're leading 18 and 19-year-olds who you're literally dependent on for your very life, it creates a different kind of leadership experience than I think a lot of people have. You start to understand very early, and I was 23 when I had that platoon, that you have to listen a lot. I was much more dependent for my success on them than they were on me, frankly. And I was very, very fortunate. I had a very wizened staff sergeant who was my platoon sergeant. I used to think of him as Methuselah. and he was all of 31 years old. And he probably did more to help me understand my role as a leader than anyone in my entire career. And Staff Sergeant Bebo would tell me, Lieutenant, I appreciate what you're trying to get done here, but you might want to try this, or try this. And so a lot of my leadership experience that I translated eventually into the private sector, into industry, came from young 18 and 19-year-old Marines and staff NCOs and NCOs like Sergeant Bebo. And frankly, that's a very different kind of leadership experience than you would have growing up in, say, just a business environment.
So taking that business environment, as you know, Mr. Havenstein, I mean, you've been running for governor for a while. You know, New Hampshire's got some serious social problems. You know, we've got homelessness. We've got drug addiction. We've got, parents working three jobs who can't properly take care of their children through no fault of their own. So how does someone who's been at the corporate level translate that experience to the public sector where the needs are very different and the demands are very different?
Well, I would hearken right back to my leadership experience growing up. First of all, I didn't start out a CEO. Right? As I said, I grew up as a one of seven kids in a very, very middle-class family, and one of seven, I had to work very hard just to get dinner, frankly.
I was in the middle of that.
And as a Marine, recognized that many of the social points that you were just mentioning, Laura, are things that Marine families have to work with every single day. And you have a young 19-year-old Marine who's married and has a child. They have those same sort of issues. And frankly, a lot of that help falls right there on the platoon commander and the platoon sergeant. Judy and I worked with lots of young people as they were growing up. And so I think we're very, very sensitive to those kind of needs.
How would that sensitivity manifest itself in a Havenstein administration?
Well, I think, first of all, it manifests itself in the fact that I'll be out listening to people who have those kind of needs. That's not something new to me. Frankly, as a CEO, I spent much more time on the factory floor than I did in the C-suite, so to speak, as people say, because that's where the value add of all the companies, at least the companies I had the pleasure of working with, that's where the value add is done in the company. So most of my leadership experience tends to be hands-on, and when you say hands-on, that means you have to be out and about with the people that you're serving. And I think some people have this sense that, you know, just because you're a CEO, you don't see your role as one of service. I always saw my role as a CEO of one of service, service not just to my customers, but service to my colleagues at the company, and I think that's very translatable to the role as governor.
Let's dig into some of the things that you've put out there as part of your plan, Mr. Havenstein. Part of your economic development plan is to go out and sell New Hampshire as a good place to start a business. So let's say I'm a business person. I'm looking at starting or expanding my business in New Hampshire.
Sure.
You and I are stuck on an elevator.
Right.
Going from floor one to floor six. How would you sell me on New Hampshire? What would you say? Give me that elevator speech, please.
Well, I think the elevator speech, first of all, you have to have something to sell. Part of the issue we have today about growing businesses in our state is we've lost what we have to sell. But let me tell you what I did do when in 1999, when Sanders was in up for sale. Lockheed Martin decided to sell Sanders, and the leadership team at Sanders had to decide how we were going to approach various bidders for the company. And at the end of the day, there were three primary bidders for Sanders. Two of those bidders wanted to take the company out of the state. The third bidder, all right, wasn't sure. And so we were, as a leadership team, when we would brief the bidders, we would sell the state. All right, we would sell. Frankly,
why you should stay in New Hampshire.
Why you should stay.
So what'd you say?
The live free or die attitude. That's number one. The culture of work of our colleagues there at Sanders, and at the time there were about 3,600 of us at the company. The high caliber of education, which was very, very important if you're going to sustain a business of any caliber, whether it's a small business or a large business. If you're going to grow, you have to have access to talent. And frankly, we had, because of the relationship at Sanders, we had developed with UNH in particular in Durham, we had a very, very strong a tie to the education system and key talent for the company. Then we were also able to, at the time, talk about a favorable tax structure when compared to other places. And some of those other places were that people were considering were outside of Baltimore. They were considering in Massachusetts, and they were considering in the Chicago area. And we were able to sell New Hampshire. And that's exactly what we did. And when BA Systems ultimately became the winning bidder, so to speak, in that process, we were able to sell them on keeping this company right here in New Hampshire. And I'm very, very proud of that.
Let's talk more about that, because those are two key pieces of your platform, the education system and also the tax structure.
Yep.
As you know, Mr. Havenstein, New Hampshire consistently rates at the bottom of the pack for higher education spending. So what would a Havenstein administration do about that, if anything?
Well, we'll have to look and see. I do know this about the spending on education. Education spending should be tied to the future employment needs of our state and in the future direction we are going strategically, and that we should make sure our investments in our young people through higher education lead to that future employment in the state. But if you don't have jobs and you're not creating jobs, right, like we're, the situation we find ourselves in today, you're going to be making investments in young people who are going to leave the state, and that's what we're seeing happen. I would tell you this, that one of the things we had to do at Sanders and subsequently at BA Systems here in Nashua is we realized early on that the demographics for our engineering population in 1999 showed that within 10 years, 50% or more of our engineers would be eligible to retire. And we had to be hiring about 150 engineers every year. What was interesting is we're getting very few of those engineers from University of New Hampshire's college system. And so at the time, the vice president of engineering, Mike Heffern, and I went to the university, met with Ann Weaver Hart, the president, and the dean of the College of Engineering and Physical Science, and said, look, if you could just modify your curriculums in electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, and computer science, you would match up with our future employment needs. And they did that. We gave them some money to do that. We invested in their labs and invested in their curriculum development. And within 2 years, we were interning. We had tripled the number of interns that were coming to us every summer from UNH.
So is it a matter of better cooperation between the private sector and the university system, or would a Havenstein administration continue the investments that the current budget makes in the university system and maybe even increase it as the university system would like?
Yeah, I think I'd certainly continue it where we are today based on my conversation with Mark Huddleston, and I've had 10 years of conversation with Mark on the future of the university.
So the $35 million that the current budget puts in,
I'm fine with that. But I want to make sure that we start to target our investments in the university that lead to that are consistent with what we see as the future employment needs for our state, right? So that those folks are coming into the university with an idea of the curriculums that they need and learning they need to get employed. And so when oftentimes people think of an economic development plan as simply a tax structure plan. It's not. It's a tax structure plan. It's a regulatory plan. It's an education plan. It's an energy plan. It's a health care plan. It has to be an integrated plan that looks over a long period of time with an expectation of where we want our state to go. And I think that's some of the frustration I think a lot of people feel in our state is we're not exactly sure where we want the state to go. And I know my conversations with President Huddleston, he's not exactly sure where to put most emphasis. That should be pulled. That emphasis should be a pull function from the business community, the employment community of the state. He ought to be taking that as a demand signal. And right now, I don't see that as an integrated part of the overall strategy of the state.
So
I can tell you that's exactly what we had to do at BA Systems to improve the number of, and quality of engineers and other technical disciplines coming out of that school. And once we did that, that has been an engine for that company for the last decade.
The university system has said it was grateful for that additional $35 million that you said you would keep, that it helped them keep tuition down.
Yep.
They're asking for another $16 million to, again, keep tuition down. As you know, Mr. Havenstein, New Hampshire students have the highest or the second highest, we keep bouncing back and forth, levels of student debt. What do you think about this, investing more state money in the university system so that our students don't graduate with so much debt?
Well, I got to tell you, I'm all for investing if it's investing in the right things. And you ought to be investing in things that are going to have a long-term impact for the careers of those students, right? Most important for those students is to make sure they have the opportunities that I saw when I came here 15 years ago so that they have the opportunities in the workforce, frankly, to apply those skills, and so they aren't required to leave our state to find adequate work.
I want to ask you about another question that has come up, boy, a lot on our program, and it's something that's affecting our communities, our families. Police are worried about it. I think you know what I'm going to say, Mr. Havenstein, and that's heroin addiction. We now have more people in New Hampshire dying from drug overdoses than traffic deaths, heroin being a big part of that. How would you, as governor, take aim at this? This is a growing concern in communities around the state.
Yeah, I know it is a growing concern. I think what we're seeing right now, and I'm disappointed that it's taken us so long to get focused on prescription drug addiction. When you talk about heroin, most of the drug addictions that we're seeing in the state started as prescription drug abuse.
Right. And then they switched to heroin because it's cheaper.
And so what we want to make sure we're doing is we're making sure we're sharing information and curbing that part of it first. Make sure we aren't enabling this addiction by having, frankly, prescription drug abuse. So let's make sure we have the information we need to make sure that people aren't over-prescribing to folks. And then we need to take a regional approach. I think a lot of the addiction we see is a result of traffic in the region. But first and foremost, let's see if we can't get these folks some help before they get addicted on prescription drugs.
There was a big Hope for Recovery rally in Concord over the weekend, and we're just hearing more and more about this. As you know, Mr. Havenstein, one thing that some people in this field are excited about is under the Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansion, substance abuse treatment is going to be covered for the first time. I've heard so many people involved in this issue say this is a welcome change. What do you think, Mr. Havenstein? Could Medicaid expansion, including substance abuse coverage, be a step toward curbing what everybody acknowledges is a very scary problem for New Hampshire?
Well, I think we're all hopeful that it will.
Do you support, I know you've talked about this a lot on the campaign trail, Medicaid expansion. This has come up again. People have said, do you support it? Do you not support it? You did sign that pledge from the group Americans for Prosperity that promises to oppose all forms of Obamacare, including Medicaid expansion. So can you clarify for us, please, Mr. Havenstein, would you work to not renew Medicaid expansion when that sunset provision comes up in a couple of years? Or would you support renewal when that sunset provision comes up in a couple of years?
I wouldn't support renewal because we need to fix it before that sunset provision comes in. And that's one of the reasons I opposed the Medicaid expansion bill from the beginning. Any bill that gives a benefit and it at some point stops giving the benefit arbitrarily, and it does arbitrarily, after, in January of 2017, that benefit goes away. And the reason they came up with an alternative benefit is they couldn't decide, frankly, how they were going to pay for that benefit in the long run. One of the reasons they couldn't decide how they were going to pay for it is they hadn't scoped it properly to begin with, making sure we were, in fact, helping the most needy citizens of our state, to include the ones that you were describing. And so, consequently, we have a law that is bringing people onto Medicaid expansion that we know is going to that's going to end.
Unless the legislature reapproves it.
But again, we can't wait to that point. It seems to me we have to make sure that we have a fix in place well before that point, that at the end of the day, we're not sitting there with the uncertainty of legislative approval for another bill, an extension, hanging over the head of those citizens. And that's why I was so disappointed that we went through with what I thought was kind of a partial solution. Some people referred to it as a pilot test. Listen, you can't pilot test with 20,000 people. That's not right.
Those are the amount of people who've already signed up. Up to 50,000 could
no matter
qualify.
How you treat that. I mean, to me, it's what I said back in April when I first made my announcement for run. It's kind of like Charlie Brown in the football, and Lucy's sitting there with a football, getting ready to pull it away, and poor Charlie trying to figure out if it becomes.
It's a great analogy. I'm so sorry I have to interrupt you. We will talk more in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Welcome to the latest in our series of Rudman Center conversations with the candidates at UNH School of Law. Our candidate is Walt Havenstein, the Republican nominee for New Hampshire governor. And Mr. Havenstein, before I go to some of the great questions that I've got from our audience here, and some questions that our listeners submitted before the show, let's finish up our Medicaid discussion.
Okay.
I interrupted your Charlie Brown Lucy and the football. Well, but you're basically saying, how can you leave people hanging after they've signed up for this coverage?
With that uncertainty. And that's, frankly, when I, in evaluating legislation that would come to my desk, are we doing something of a temporary nature that frankly, is inappropriate? Or we really have long-term solutions when we solve these problems?
Well,
and that's what concerned me about that particular bill and frankly, how we constructed it. And that's why I opposed it.
And two more questions for you, if I could. So that sunset provision, that was something that Republicans wanted as a compromise, as a way to say, okay, let's try it. So if you were governor, would you have told your Republican colleagues, you know, don't do this?
Yeah, I would have said, don't do this. Don't expand.
Don't do the sunset.
Don't make it sunset. If you've got a program and a program that we want to have for certain people in our state, all right, let's make sure we can afford it. And make sure we can afford it for the long haul, right? As opposed to hoping that something downstream is going to change, right? Or we're going to come up with some funding mechanism later. I think that's irresponsible. That's one of the issues I had with, frankly, the Medicaid expansion in general.
Let's talk about that beyond the sunset provision, because the feds will cover it up to 100%, as you know, for the first 3 years, and then it's 90% after. So it's going to cost the state, but not the full freight.
Well, it's not going to cost the state the full freight. But I got to tell you something. Everybody who says, well, they're going to pay 90% of it. There's still the cost associated with 10% of it. And do we have realistic projections to make sure that we can pay that 10%? Or are we going to have to do something, or we're going to have to be willing to trade that off? And you know why we have to make those decisions? Because our economy is growing at 0.9%. We have no growth in revenue. And so when you're trying to commit to a long-term program and you don't have the confidence in the growth in revenue for the state, you frankly can't do it.
I want to ask you definitely questions about growth. You got a lot of jobs there and so forth. But just to wrap up the Medicaid conversation, so the pledge from AFP said, I will oppose all forms of Obamacare, including Medicaid expansion. You signed it.
Yep.
Do you support the concept of Medicaid expansion? Never mind the sunset and how New Hampshire did it, but just this idea of expanding this population of
folks. I do support the concept of making sure we have access for those most needy in our state. I absolutely support that. And having said that, I got to tell you, there's probably nothing more disappointing to me than the rollout of the Affordable Care Act and the uncertainty that has created, not just in our business community, but in just about every household in our state. The uncertainty of what's going to cost us, the uncertainty what benefits I'm going to get, the uncertainty of my doctors or my hospitals, and frankly, where I'm going to get insurance. And you're looking at somebody who went on Medicare this year, and I'm very sympathetic with people who are now seeing bills for Medicare that frankly exceeded their expectation, their wildest expectation for what it was going to cost them.
So there'll be more providers coming onto the exchanges.
It'll be interesting to see that.
More choice. Just
make sure you said the right word, hope. Right? I believe in a broader choice in the healthcare system. I believe in bringing more providers. But if they don't have a broad network, if they don't include the majority of our hospitals, more hospitals than we have today, to pick up more of the doctors that are affiliated with our hospital, we have made no progress. And I would also remind you that we're subsidizing those people coming into the market. They're being subsidized. And at some point, that subsidy is going to go away. And if we haven't corrected the structural issues around that those providers, we're going to have this problem again. Let me tell you what I did at BA Systems. Back in the 90s, some of you may remember, we started seeing all our healthcare providers leaving the state. It was by design. We were trying to limit things, go to community-based evaluations and what have you. We were forced to consider only having one source for our benefits program at BAE Systems. I rejected that. I rejected that.
Not enough choice.
Not enough choice. And let me tell you, choice, and I remember the folks at BAE Systems, my bosses, saying, nope, go to one, it'll save you $180,000 a year. Forget the number. And I kept going back to them and said, you don't understand. Choice equals freedom in New Hampshire. Choice equals freedom. That's how people think about it. So we worked very, very hard, and we kept Harvard Pilgrim as one of our suppliers. And I can tell you this right now. Harvard Pilgrim probably wouldn't have been in the state if they didn't have the 4,000 employees and families at BAE Systems, all right, as part of their base.
Wow.
And I kept Harvard Pilgrim for a long, long time.
Kind of had to at that point.
But it was a choice. It was a choice I had.
We could probably, I could ask you 15 more questions about healthcare. No. And I've got a stack of cards here from our audience and a lot more questions about some of your economic ideas. And here's a question at that point from our audience. This person didn't give a name, but thank you very much. This person says, you claim in your ads that you will create 25,000 new jobs in New Hampshire. Yep. Please explain what kind of jobs you plan to create and what sector of our economy / workforce will benefit from your claims. Will these jobs be paying well above the minimum wage? Thank you to the person who asked that question.
Yeah, I think the keep in mind the government doesn't create jobs except for government jobs. The jobs that created in the private sector will be created by the private sector because they have a business climate that makes sense for them to invest in New Hampshire. They don't have that environment today, frankly. All right, we have the highest corporate tax rate in the region, the third highest in the country. So when businesses are trying to decide whether to make investments in New Hampshire versus other places, on the margin, it doesn't make sense to do it in New Hampshire. And that's exactly what we've seen.
Why you're proposing to lower the corporate tax rate here in New Hampshire.
That's why I want to lower the corporate tax rate from its current 8.5% in two steps down to 7.4%. That'll make us once again competitive. We talk about selling the state. You got to have something to sell.
You got
to have a competitive environment
to
sell. And if we did have a competitive environment, I know we can sell the state because I've done it in the past.
I've looked a lot at New Hampshire's economy and the New England economy. I keep reading that Massachusetts and Vermont are leading New England, and they're both thought of as high tax, high social service states. So I'm wondering, is there something else going on there besides this corporate tax rate?
I suspect there may be other things going on there, but I know what's not going on in New Hampshire. You know, and oh, by the way, trailing Vermont in economic development, excuse me, and Rhode Island.
Well, Rhode Island's unemployment rate is not anything New Hampshire wants.
I'm talking about their economic growth profiles, all right? They're growing faster than we are.
Although some people say if you start at the bottom, your growth rates look terrific.
Nice try. I don't buy that. Right?
I'm just trying to put that out there, that if your growth rates are way down here and you grow a little bit, it looks like a lot.
Listen,
in terms
if
of
you,
your rate.
If you think 0.9% is great growth, less than half the national average, about 40% of what we see in the neighboring state of Massachusetts, I just don't accept that. I don't accept that. I know we can do better. We've done better. Why we're not leading New England out of this recovery like we have every other recovery in the last 40 years is because of the structures we've been put in place over the last decade and a half.
What about demographics, Mr. Havenstein? Some people say our aging population is partly to blame, not to get, you know, you said you were on Medicare, not to get personal on this. I'm getting close, so I understand. But some people say, look, when you have an aging population, you have fewer people working, and that the population is shrinking, and that is this demographic challenge is part of the reason why our economy is growing more slowly. I just wonder what you think about that and how you would address that demographic challenge.
You got the chicken and the egg backwards. I think you got the chicken and the egg backwards. Our demographics is shifting because we don't have opportunities for young people. Right? And if we don't get that turned around, it's going to be, I'll use this term and I hope I don't offend anybody, it's a death spiral for us. We are not going to have the resources we need, all right, to solve many of the other problems we have especially if we keep spending the way we're spending. We will spend ourselves right towards an income tax That's what concerns me. Then it's not just an issue of our young people. It's going to be an issue for every one of us.
So how do you bring those young people back? How do you say, this is a great state, you should come here?
Well, I yell at my son every chance I get, which you don't realize. One of the motivating factors for me was 15 months ago, my son, who is living in Bedford, working in Merrimack, he called me and said, Dad, I've got an opportunity for promotion. What parent doesn't want to hear that, right? And we had a nice long discussion, and he told me, hey, but the opportunity's in Texas. And I said, time out. Before you make any decisions, why don't we look and see what opportunities there might be here in New Hampshire? And he was in the aerospace industry, still is, like I was. And so, I went back to friends and colleagues and people that I thought where his skills might in the future have opportunities for him. And frankly, there weren't. And so at the end of the day, I said, well, your children are young. If you're going to make a move, now's the time to make a move. And so they moved to Texas. And then I had to deal with Mum, right? Judy, my wife, and saying, what were you thinking? I said, well, wait a minute. And because in addition to my son going to Texas, which I think she thought was okay, she took my daughter-in-law from Derry and my two granddaughters, at the time 2 and 4 years old. Look, and this situation is not unique to Walt and Judy Havenstein. I'm seeing this situation as I go around the state for more and more people, where their young people, their sons and daughters are leaving the state.
I do hear stories like that, too. One of the leading economists of the state who's looked at this has kids who live outside of the state. But one of the things that tends to attract businesses and young people to the state, Mr. Havenstein, I'm sure you know this, a lovely environment, good schools, a good health care system, good roads, maybe some public transit. There are studies that say that young people today, they don't want to drive as much as we do. They want to take trains and buses and so forth. And yet the plans that you've presented are projected to create holes in the state budget. So where would you find the money to invest in these wonderful things that will bring young people to the state? Speaking of chicken and egg,
right. You can't have an economic development plan that only focuses in one area, right? Frankly, that's what we've seen here in Concord for more than a decade, what I call economic whack-a-mole, right? We got to solve a tax problem, whack. We got to solve a health care problem, whack. We got to solve an education problem, whack. We have to have an integrated strategy, right? A 10-year economic development strategy that includes energy, health care, right? Infrastructure, includes regulations, right? Includes tax structure, right? That's how you make sure you're creating all those things in parallel, right? Now, we do have to make sure that at the same time we're creating those opportunities for those young people. And frankly, I think we can do that.
So where does the money come from for health care, education, infrastructure? Where does that cash come from?
Coming from 8.5 down to 7.4 over two cycles, right, two budgetary cycles. And that'll mean that we're going to have to find about $90 million out of our current projected profile. And I haven't included in any of my assessments, future revenue growth from future economic growth. I've just discounted that completely. We are going to have to find about 2.5% of efficiency in aggregate across our state spending.
To pay for the $90 million.
To pay for that. I would caution you, I don't know too many people who don't believe that we have 2.5% efficiency gains in our state spending. At BAE Systems, I had historically 3-5% efficiency goals year after year after year after year.
Can you give some examples
hit those goals.
Of how you did that?
Sure, yeah.
Was it better lighting? Was it better heating?
I mean, better processing.
Cheaper paper.
Wherever we could find an opportunity to reduce costs, we would look for it. Can we be more efficient in how we buy things? Do we share information better so people are making better decisions? Oh, by the way, we did this as we were growing. We grew year after year after year after year. So I would simply say there are plenty of different ways to affect those efficiencies. One of the key roles is a chief executive officer, whether you're the governor or the CEO of BA Systems or the president of Sanders, is helping people and teaching people how to create those savings, right? How to create that efficiency. And sometimes you have to rely on outside folks to help you do it. But most of the time, the people, the leaders right there, the subordinate leaders in your organization, know exactly what needs to be done.
The people running the state agencies in this instance.
And their co-workers. And I know sometimes people say, well, that means they're trying to work themselves right out of a job. No. What you're really trying to do is help them be more efficient in the job they have.
Mr. Einstein, that
you're not growing state government faster than you're growing the economic growth of the state. And that's what we've seen over the last decade. That is unsustainable, folks. It just simply is.
We talked earlier about how, you know, private sector, public sector, how different they are, mm-hmm. and yet how you hope to bring some of that experience. When people hear 2.5% efficiency, for some people, not everybody, that's code for cuts, reductions in services like health and public safety. What do you think, Mr. Havenstein? How do you apply that private sector idea at BAE that you described to the public sector, where, again, the needs and priorities are so different, where a reduction in spending could mean, you know, a less bed for a mental health patient, one less state trooper on the highway? That's the concern. Efficiency means, you know, cuts that could be scary for some folks.
And I appreciate that. I would simply tell you that there are ways to create efficiency so that you're not spending more. You're not hiring more, right? You're reallocating talent to do much more important and higher priority work than what you were doing before. And that, frankly, is probably where you get the most efficiency, is in reallocating work. And I got to tell you, my experience, and I know you keep harking on my CEO experience. Listen, my first 12 years of leadership experience was in the Marine Corps, and the last six of that was doing acquisition work within the Department of Defense for the Marine Corps, arguably the largest bureaucracy in our country. And we were able to create efficiency. We were able to create improvements in our yields, whether it's in the factory or in the engineering world or in the administration. And as a result of that, more and more resource went to the value-added part of that acquisition process. So I reject the premise that there are not things in my background that are directly applicable to government and government deficiencies.
We will talk more after a very short break. I've got a stack of cards from our wonderful audience here, so we'll go to those in just a moment. And more questions and comments for Mr. Walt Havenstein, the Republican gubernatorial nominee. More in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Welcome back to our campaign series of Rudman Center Conversations with the Candidates at UNH School of Law. Our candidate is the Republican nominee for New Hampshire Governor, Walt Havenstein. And Mr. Havenstein, as I said earlier, we've got lots of questions from our audience here. So let's go to a couple more of them. And again, I appreciate everybody who submitted questions, both before this program and while we're here. Here's someone from Wendy who emailed us before the show, who says, where do you stand on gay marriage?
I support gay marriage.
That was easy.
Sure.
I did want to ask you, Mr. Havenstein, opposition to gay marriage was in the Republican Party's official plank that was updated just recently, along with a so-called personhood amendment, which people on that side of the issue anyway, fear if it was carried out would ban abortion, perhaps even some forms of contraception. What do you think about this personhood plank, along with the gay marriage plank in the party platform?
I support gay marriage. And I support a woman's right to choose.
When you announced for governor, you called yourself pro-choice. Did you make your views known at the time that this plank was approved, given that you're sort of the nominee for the top of the ticket?
Well, when I made my announcement that I was going to run for governor, according to a UNH poll, only 7% of the people in the state knew who I was. And my wife Judy wanted to know who the 7% were. and so for anybody in the Republican Party to assume that I may have a different point of view than the plank, I think, or the party platform, I think would have been presumptuous on my part. Having said that, I sat in on the platform committee hearings 2 years ago during the 2012 cycle. My wife Judy was a member of that platform committee. They were nice enough to let me go around to the town halls to listen. I appreciate that we have differences in the Republican Party when it comes to certain issues. I respect and in many cases admire those differences. But we have differences. Guess what? We have differences in many, many things across our state. I had many, many differences of opinion within my leadership team at SAIC and BAE Systems. It starts by making sure people understand where you're coming from and your willingness to sit down and have a civil conversation about it. That's how I see those.
Well, couple questions,
sure,
on these. Again, these tough social issues. So I appreciate people writing these in. Here's an email from Natalie that came in before. Would you veto an attempt to defund Planned Parenthood? Thanks, Natalie.
Well, yes, I would. And the reason I would is frankly, there are a lot of women's health care issues that are supported by Planned Parenthood. Yeah, there's some issues that I take exception to by Planned Parenthood, but I have no intention at this point to defund Planned Parenthood.
Here's a Facebook comment that we got earlier from Anthony. He says, if the state legislature passed a bill decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana for recreational use, would you veto the bill? So that's not legalization, but decriminalization, which some people are talking about.
I've said all along that I would consider a marijuana decriminalization bill, but it's going to depend upon the bill. And although I'm not in favor of legalizing marijuana, I would consider decriminalization based upon the facts of the bill. And so I would tell you right off, unless the bill was extraordinarily unacceptable, I wouldn't veto it.
Here's another email that we got from Jim, who says, would you have signed the Paycheck Fairness Act? This,
yes,
had bipartisan support. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Well,
let me make a comment about that.
Yeah.
I've supported equal pay for equal work my entire life, right? If you're a PFC in the Marine Corps, you're a PFC in the Marine Corps. Right? If you're a Lance Corporal, if you're a Sergeant, you're a Lieutenant. There's nothing on your ID card that says male, female, therefore you must deal differently with them. There isn't. Frankly, I'm very proud of, within the aerospace industry, the work we've done at BAE Systems and SAIC when it comes to promoting and including all diversity in our promotion activities. My successor at BAE Systems was a woman I hired to run one of our operating groups, and after 3 years, she succeeded me as CEO. Right? We only had two operating groups. My general counsel at BAE Systems was a Dartmouth grad. She used to kid me all the time about skiing on our ski slopes. One of the three group presidents, executive vice presidents at SAIC, was a magnificent woman who's now gone on to be the CEO of her own company. And I promoted a lady out of our Charleston operations in South Carolina to come up and be a senior executive at SAIC. And today, she's the Secretary of the Air Force.
So no problem with women in leadership positions there.
Listen, it's all about inclusion. It's all about inclusion and making sure you have the right people doing the right jobs.
Here's another card from our audience. This person says, this is Jack. He says, if the legislature approves a bill to replace capital punishment with life in prison with no possibility of parole, would you sign that bill? Jack, thank you for the question.
No.
So in favor of the death penalty.
I would not repeal the death penalty law that we have in this state. There are certain crimes, I believe, that are so heinous that it is important that we have that option available to us. And one of those heinous crimes is when it comes to murdering a law enforcement officer in the performance of their duty.
And that's definitely part of New Hampshire's death penalty
that
law.
Exactly.
Right,
we
now
have a very narrow statute here. And let me tell you why I believe that. And it's something I believe most of my life. One of the things most people don't know about BAE Systems, we make the majority of body armor for law enforcement agencies in this country under a brand name called Safariland, something you all wouldn't know about, right? Safariland 2 weeks ago announced the 1,900 save, 1,900 saves from body armor that they produce and sell to our law enforcement agies. 1,900. That's
personal,
a lot of saves.
A real personal connection there.
It's not just a personal connection. It reminds me every day the dangers our law enforcement folks, the dangers they expose themselves to in serving us. They get a lot of grief when somebody does something wrong, and yet nobody ever talks about the magnificent things they do for us.
I'm going to be
outspoken about the magnificent things they do for us. I can tell you that.
Although some of the major law enforcement groups in the state have supported your opponent, Governor Hassan, including the state troopers.
Perfect.
Let me ask you another question about law enforcement, crime and punishment, while we're at it,
yeah, sure.
Mr. Havenstein. As you know, the idea of what New Hampshire's gun laws should and should not be has been at play. I mean, people have talked about this for a long, long time. One of the things that's percolating right now is a bill to allow what's called constitutional carry, which basically says if you own a gun, you can carry it. You don't need a special permit. Representative Hole is behind this from Dunbarton. Is this a good idea? Because mentioning law enforcement, some in law enforcement are pretty nervous about this.
Well, I'm not nervous about it. I support it. I think... you know, unless someone is a criminal, right, or unless someone is known to not have the mental capacities to be responsible, we should have constitutional carry. I support that.
Let me ask you another question. This has been on the agenda also in New Hampshire, especially as the weather gets colder. And you know what I'm going to ask, Mr. Havenstein. Energy costs, you've said, and many agree that New Hampshire's high energy costs are scaring off businesses, hurting families, hurting our economic future. What does a Governor Havenstein do to alleviate that?
Well, first of all, I start implementing a long-term plan, right? And to implement a long-term plan, you have to have one.
I think the state just approved a 10-year energy plan, didn't
interesting
it?
Interesting enough in that, and I'm glad you mentioned that, interesting enough, there's no mention of natural gas expansion. There's no mention of hydroelectric. Yeah, lots about weatherization, right? Putting weather strips under your doors and windows and conservation. But we don't have a plan that is actionable. It's one thing to have a plan and say, don't we have a nice plan or a strategy? But if it's not actionable, we're going to find ourselves 10 years from today exactly where we are today.
So where would you start? What actions would you start?
There are three areas that are really important that we need to focus on. The lowest cost base energy for our state is hydroelectric, whether it's done in a microgrid with small hydroelectric plants or bringing in hydroelectric like from Hydro-Quebec, right, bringing in power from the north. The second thing we need to focus on is expanding our natural gas capacity, and not just the capacity into the state, but distribution within the state so it goes to places other than just industrial users and onesie-twosie residential constraint. That, I believe, the private sector is willing to invest in if they see if they see policies of a consistent nature that make their investment worthwhile. I think we need to expand propane and propane distribution in the state. It represents 17 to 18% of all fuel resources used in our state. And yet we've pushed off additional distribution capabilities within the state. I think we need to do that. I would also tell you, my focus on energy investment is on reducing the rates that people charge to the payers in New Hampshire, whether they're residential payers or business payers. And that is my principal focus. When we're trying to get our economy moving, let's not be subsidizing inefficient sources of electricity and power. We can't afford to do that.
I want to ask you about how did you get started? You mentioned hydro, and that's interesting. And my understanding is hydro right now is between 7, 6, 8% of our energy mix.
Right.
Mr. Havenstein.
That's okay.
But as you know, Northern Pass, that's the big hydro power project that people are talking about in New Hampshire. And from what I've heard, you and Governor Hassan both have a similar position on this, that you do not support the project in its current form. In other words, having the lines mostly not buried. There's a plan to bury, 8 or so miles. So pull that into your support for hydro.
Yeah, I don't support the plan that's currently proposed for Northern Pass. You know, sometimes we find ourselves in the political world when somebody asks the questions, do you support or oppose Northern Pass? And they make it a yes or no. That is not the way the world works, folks. The question we ought to be asking ourselves is, how do we make this work for New Hampshire? How do we make it work?
How do you think you could make it work?
Well, first of all, I need to see proposals that I can make an evaluation on, both technically and economically, as to what the alternatives look like. I don't think we've gotten clear alternative solutions to consider, to consider burying it completely.
PSNH has said that's hugely expensive. We've talked to them about
that. You know
something?
They're going to have to sit down with me and explain that to me. Unlike the governor, I know the difference between a decibel and a dumbbell, okay? I actually have 2 degrees in engineering. One of them in electrical engineering. I can have that conversation. I've actually had to do marginal cost analysis. I've actually been responsible for building electrical plants.
So not a 100% opposition to Northern Pass. Let's sit down. Let's talk about it. Let's see
what
can make it work.
I'm 100% opposed to what they currently have on proposed. I'm 100% because that's not a balanced approach for New Hampshire. It's not a balanced, and whatever solution we come up with, if we come up with a solution, has to be a balanced approach for New Hampshire. Has to consider the North Country, right? It has to consider the economic impacts for rate reduction in our state. And it has to be New Hampshire first, not just the regional grid. All right? I want to make sure that New Hampshire is getting the benefit of any project like that, whether it's natural gas, propane, hydroelectric.
I haven't heard you mention the three big alternatives that other people often mention: wind, solar, and biomass. Any interest there?
Well,
North Country loves biomass, for example. They've got a lot of trees.
So I do support biomass in New Hampshire. Because it is a supportive industry, it's base power, first of all, so you can put it right into the grid, and number two, it has a economic advantage as part of it, and that's for our landowners and our forestry industry. So I support that. I do not support wind turbines, and frankly, I don't support solar because they do not fundamentally compete economically with other sources. They don't compete because they're not base power. So you gotta
intermittent,
and frankly, we're subsidizing them. And I won't. It doesn't make sense for us when our rates are as high as they are that we should be subsidizing those technologies.
Some people say they cost a lot now, but that's the future. You go over to Vermont, there's solar panels everywhere.
Okay.
Just wonder what you think.
Well, go to Vermont. I'm not suggesting for a second that it might not be good for Vermont. Right? Let me tell you something.
Not part of our future, though.
They're not part of. You drive up north, you go by Rumney and Plymouth, and you see our beautiful landscape dotted with these wind turbines, and recognize that we're paying for that in a subsidy in our electric bills just does not make sense to me. It just does not make sense. And we have the wherewithal in this country and this state not to have to depend upon that. It's nice to have the technology available. Certainly nice to have the technology available. But we shouldn't be betting our economic future on subsidies to that industry.
And Mr. Havenstein, lots more to talk about.
Yeah.
But we have to wrap it up here. I wanted everybody to know that our next forum is right back here on Thursday with Carol Shea Porter, Democratic First District Congresswoman. Go to nhpr.org for more information. Check out the whole schedule. I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight, especially thank the team at NHPR and UNH Law. And to you, Mr. Havenstein, for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Well, I hope you, Laura, as we go forward, you'll call me Walt. And I keep looking around for my dad when you say Mr. Havenstein. I know I shouldn't. I'm 65, but
this is The Exchange on NHPR.